I don't need someone to speak for me. And I relish the day that I get to face him and speak my truth.
Well, got good news for you, Stormy Daniels. Your lucky day has come.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
You know what I mean?
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and elsewhere in California and Oregon and Pennsylvania and Hawaii and Ohio and New York and Louisiana and New Mexico and New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, West Virginia. Got a message for you folks in West Virginia today. Wisconsin and Minnesota, not to mention a whole bunch of your favorite podcast sites and streaming networks. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. All right, coming up, it is our midweek Trump trial catch-up with a K, maybe in this case with a triple X, as porn star Stormy Daniels finally takes the stand this week in Trump's New York 2016 election interference and hush money case. We will get to that and our two swell guests in a moment, along with our always swell Desi Doyen. How are you?
Yes, doing all right.
Are you swelling? Anyway, first, on Tuesday in Indiana, voters went to the primary polls, predominantly on the Republican side, where there are a number of open seats for the U.S. House and Senate and the state's governor's mansion in the otherwise very red state. While Joe Biden ran uncontested in the Democratic presidential primary on Tuesday, there was, as Politico describes it in any event, quote, unexpected warning signs for Donald Trump. That despite the fact that both he and Joe Biden already have captured enough of their party's respective delegates to win their party nominations officially at their national party conventions over the summer. But while Biden ran uncontested on the Democratic side, Trump continues to show signs, at least, of weakness among his own party's faithful. As Politico reports, in 2016, Indiana put Donald Trump on the doorstep of the GOP presidential nomination. But 8 years later, the state he called Importantville delivered his campaign some flashing red warning signs as Nikki Haley cleaned up in the suburbs on Tuesday. A zombie Haley candidacy, they write, continued to punch above its weight in the Trumpiest of states. The former South Carolina governor is on track to break 20% for the first time since she dropped out of the race 2 months ago. In fact, as it turns out, with more than 95% of the vote now tallied, Haley is on track to win just under 22%. Of the Indiana Republican primary vote.
Wow, not bad for a zombie.
She's not even officially running anymore.
Yeah.
Indiana delivered the former president double point margins in 2016 and 2020, notes Politico. But on Tuesday night, even though Trump won all of the state's 58 delegates, Nikki Haley posted above 30 point performances in places like Marion County, home to Indianapolis, and the affluent Hamilton County, its suburb to the north. This, they write, is where Biden grew Democratic margins in 2020 and where Indiana Democrats have been targeting for years, and it's the same kind of place where Trump has been weak throughout the 2024 GOP primary in other states as well. They note, while virtually no one doubts Indiana will be in Trump's column come November, Tuesday's results show a durable coalition for Haley. In fact, Haley was on track to score more votes than the second-place finisher in the $40 million GOP gubernatorial contest. That would be Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch. winning more than 100,000 votes. This after Trump said, without evidence, that she wouldn't make the ballot earlier this year. As of Wednesday morning, in fact, Haley had more than 128,000 votes in her column in Indiana. The state's senior senator, Todd Young, Republican, has said he will not back Donald Trump. He outperformed the former president's 2020 margin in his 2022 re-election bid. As well, former Vice President Mike Pence, an Indiana voter, has also, of course, said that he would not back Trump. Now, where Politico sees Tuesday's results in the Indiana Republican primary as a sign of Haley's coalition being, quote, durable, I would argue it suggests that Trump's coalition continues to be strained at best. He has consistently underperformed in this year's primaries, week after week after week, in state after state, at least for someone who was supposed to be running as the ostensible incumbent candidate as a former president. All of that said, as Politico notes, and as I believe we mentioned in advance of Tuesday's primaries, Indiana runs open primaries. So Haley's totals, Politico argues, may have been boosted by voters outside the GOP base that who were participating in the primary. Indiana voters do not register with a political party. They get to choose which primary they would prefer to vote in. And with the Republican gubernatorial primary dominating the airwaves in the state, not to mention Biden running uncontested on the Democratic side, Politico suggests that a broader swath of voters than Trump's core supporters may have been motivated to pull Republican ballots.
May have, but it echoes a trend in states that have closed primaries, yep, where Republican voters have also turned out for Haley.
Outside of the presidential race, it was a panoply of open Republican primaries for Senate, governor, three congressional seats that made Indiana a major battleground for the various GOP factions fighting for influence in this Republican Party. On Tuesday, Senator Mike Braun prevailed in the open race for governor, and Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, who announced her retirement last year, but then unretired shortly before the primary deadline, when there were eight Republicans running for that open, what they thought was an open seat. Well, Victoria Spartz looks like she actually won. She barely survived that primary, but it looks like she will be the incumbent running this November. The rest was sort of a mix of self-funded millionaires and outside groups spending millions of dollars to jockey for their preferred candidates for several of those open seats. There seems to be no clear consensus about which GOP factions won or lost on Tuesday, with those presidential results being, at least to my eye this morning, really the most telling right now. I have neither seen nor heard of any notable problems for voters or for tabulation of votes on Tuesday so far. That's a good sign.
Yeah.
Though, as we have seen in past years and primary elections with lower turnout than generals, when it's much less partisan, much less nationalized, much less direct competition and dirty tricks by Republicans, well, those elections tend to go a little bit smoother, at least they have in recent years, than general elections themselves. Next Tuesday, voters in Nebraska, Maryland, and West Virginia head to the polls for a similar exercise. If you live in one of those states or you know someone who does, it's a great time to get out and vote, even if it's just practice for November, to make sure that you know how to do it, to know where your polling place is, if you're voting in person, and to assure that you are, for now anyway, still registered to vote as you think you are. Better to learn about any problems now rather than waiting until it really counts on November 5th this year.
Especially if you've been standing in line for a long time only to find out you don't have what you need.
For now, I will note just one point about next week's primaries. Most of the action in West Virginia, naturally, is going to be on the Republican side in what may be, I think, just about the reddest nation in the union. Though, now that we're on at our affiliate AM 1700 in Fairmont, West Virginia, I'm hoping to change that. But one race is worth noting for now. Right-wing Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Manchin is finally retiring this year, so there's a race to fill the seat that he's vacating, which will probably go to a Republican, since Manchin is believed to be just about the last guy who had a D by his name who could win a statewide race in West Virginia. Even their billionaire or former billionaire coal baron governor, Jim Justice, he ran for governor as a Democrat back in 2016, but he became a Republican almost immediately after taking office in that election. He flipped.
Big old bait and switch.
He's now termed out, Jim Justice, from the governor's office, but he is likely to be the GOP nominee to replace Joe Manchin in the U.S. Senate on the Republican side. But on the Democratic side of that primary next week, one of the candidates is a guy named Don Blankenship. Desi apparently knows who he is.
Yes, I do.
He is a former coal baron who was once the CEO of Massey Energy. I think it was the sixth largest coal company in the nation at the time. He is also a criminal who repeatedly conspired to violate mine safety standards, at least up until the notorious 2010 explosion at Massey's Upper Big Branch mine, which resulted in the deaths of 29 mine workers. Blankenship went to prison for a year for that, and then he came out and he ran for the U.S. Senate as a Republican against Joe Manchin, who defeated him back in 2018. Now, the kind of crazy, certainly criminal, former coal boss Blankenship is running for U.S. Senate again, but this time he's doing it as a Democrat in West Virginia. I'm not sure who he's going to fool with that, or if it's his way of trying to make sure that Republican Jim Justice wins on the Republican side, but I wanted to mention that to our West Virginia listeners, that crazy Don Blankenship is on the ballot on Tuesday as a Democrat, of all things, running for the nomination for the U.S. Senate against unapologetic pro-union candidate Glenn Elliott, Marine Corps vet and grassroots organizer Zach Shrewsbury. So just wanted to give you a heads up on that. As you know, in this particular year, I've argued that it's, you know, democracy versus autocracy on the ballot, and that the Democratic Party right now generally is on the Democratic side, on the democracy side, with Republicans on the autocracy side. But in this case, if Blankenship wins the Democratic primary, I might have a very different thought about that, about who West Virginians should vote for in November. So just noting that to our friends in West Virginia who are voting in the Democratic primary next week, Glenn Elliott or Zach Shrewsbury would be excellent choices on the Democratic U.S. Senate primary ballot, for what it's worth. All right, let's take a quick break here. We will return with our Trump trial midweek catch-up with a K with our friends Heather Digby Parton and attorney Keith Barber as Stormy takes the stand. And if you have small children in the room, well, we'll try to keep it clean. No promises, however. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I know why he can't hold his head up high. Stormy Daniels.
Yeah, especially now.
She went through all the legal channels.
That's what she says.
Keeps talking all the time.
Yes, She does. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Stormy Daniels, the adult film actress at the center of Donald Trump's hush money trial, testified Tuesday about the disturbing sexual encounter she says she had with him, leading to angry, profane muttering from the former president at the trial, which alarmed the judge. New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan called Trump's lawyer Todd Blanche to a sidebar during a midday break to say, according to the transcript that was released at the end of the day, that Trump was, quote, cursing audibly and possibly intimidating Daniels during her testimony. Quote, I understand that your client is upset at this point, Merchan said to the defense attorney, but he is cursing audibly and is shaking his head visually, and that's contemptuous. It has the potential to intimidate the witness, and the jury can see that, the judge said. Blanche assured the judge at least three times that he would speak to his client about it. Quote, I am speaking to you here at the bench because I don't want to embarrass him, Judge Merchan said. You need to speak to him. I won't tolerate that. Blanche promised again that he would speak to Trump. The exchange, according to the New York Times, is telling, punctuated a day of rage on Tuesday, sometimes whispered from the defense table, sometimes declared loudly by Daniels herself from the witness stand. It was one of the several surreal moments on the 13th day of the first criminal trial of a former U.S. president, including descriptions by Daniels of their alleged sexual encounter in 2006 that were so detailed that the defense attorneys demanded a mistrial. While Merchan rejected that request, Daniels at times seemed to be describing non-consensual sex that could be considered highly prejudicial for the jury, which in turn could give Trump, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee, solid grounds to appeal if he is found guilty in this case. Trump is accused of 34 felony counts of falsifying business records for allegedly disguising financial transactions related to a $130,000 hush money payment made to Daniels just before the 2016 election to keep her quiet about what she said happened between them. He has denied the charges, denied having sex with Daniels, and even claimed at one point when the charges first came to light that he had no idea who this woman was, that he had never even seen her before. Daniels insisted on the stand there was nothing about the years of bad blood between her and Trump that made her story untrue. Still, her dislike of the defendant, according to the Times, according to the transcript, according to multiple accounts of Tuesday's testimony, her dislike was palpable in the courtroom. Daniels described first meeting Trump at a golf event in Lake Tahoe and being invited by his security guard to dinner with Trump. She met him at his hotel suite that night, where she was surprised to find him in silk pajamas before instructing him to change clothes to something more appropriate. When she got there, they spoke for a while. She says she asked him if he was always that rude. Apparently, there was never any dinner. But then, to her surprise, after using a restroom in the suite off of his bedroom, she emerged to find Trump wearing only a T-shirt and boxers and posing on the bed. Quote, that's when I had that moment when I felt like the room spun in full motion, she testified, and I felt the blood leave my hands and my feet, almost like if you stand up too fast, she said. Trump, quote, stood up between me and the door, not in a threatening manner, though she said she felt an imbalance of power, particularly with Trump's security guard standing just outside of the suite. I think I blacked out, she said, adding that there were many details she didn't remember, but insisting that she was not drugged or drunk. Next thing I know, I was on the bed, she testified. I was staring at the ceiling. I didn't know how I got there. She said the encounter, which we will not go into further details about, and the judge had instructed the prosecution to do so as well, that encounter, she said, was brief. Before Daniels testified, Trump's lawyers argued that it would be unfair to tell the jury salacious details about an alleged sexual encounter that is not part of the specific charges against him. And while Justice Merchan warned the prosecutors not to go into great detail about the alleged encounter, Stormy Daniels nonetheless offered a lengthy description of a sexual experience that often did not sound consensual, along with a raft of other details down to the brand of shampoo in his bathroom. Pert Plus, if you're wondering. Plus Old Spice, because of course. Outside the courtroom, Trump told reporters that the prosecutor's case, quote, is totally falling apart, he said. It's just a disaster for the DA. This whole case is just a disaster. Maybe. But for the DA or for him? We'll get thoughts on that momentarily from our guests. Additional testimony over the past week since we last did a deep dive on the trial also came from longtime Trump aide Hope Hicks, who had a front row seat to Trump's various conversations with both National Enquirer publisher David Pecker and Trump fixer and attorney turned hush money payer Michael Cohen before the 2016 election and during Trump's time in the White House. She described her testimony the chaos that descended upon Trump's 2016 campaign when the Access Hollywood tape, in which Trump is heard bragging about sexually assaulting women, when that was first made public, leading to the eventual hush money agreements with Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Hicks cried on the stand at one point after testifying that she did not really believe Trump's story that Cohen had paid off Daniels without telling anyone out of the kindness of his heart. Once all of this came to light, thanks to a story by the Wall Street Journal, I believe, in 2018, Trump Organization bookkeepers, such as its controller and accounts payable officers, testified to how checks were cut and signed by Donald Trump while he served in the White House to reimburse Cohen from Trump's personal checking account to cover the hush money payments made to Daniels just before the 2016 election. And on Tuesday, in related matters in Trump's other criminal trials, the Trump-appointed federal judge overseeing his stolen national security documents case in Florida, U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, postponed the previously scheduled May 20 trial start date indefinitely, claiming there was just too much pretrial work that still needs to be done. And in Georgia, on Wednesday, the state appeals court agreed to hear Trump's appeal that Fulton County District Attorney Fani Willis should be removed from his 2020 election interference conspiracy case in the state after the lower court judge rejected that same motion some weeks ago. Joining us now for insight and explanation for all of the above and probably more are our two old friends, Heather Digby Parton, the award-winning columnist at Salon and longtime blogger at Digby's Hullabaloo, and former attorney and former lifelong Republican Keith Barber, who now blogs at the Progressive Daily Coast website on legal matters. And, of course, he is also the father of Bethany Barber, whose dulcet tones kicked off this segment. Welcome back to the broadcast to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Brad.
All right, Heather, I have got a lot of legal questions that I want to direct to Keith today on all of this. So let me first begin with you to sort of get the broader picture before we dive into some of the details on how all of this is going. How is the trial playing? Do you sense that the general public is getting this, is paying attention? How's it being received by the Trumpers, whether it be, you know, what we learned via social media or right-wing Fox News type outlets? What's your sort of broad take on where we are in this trial now in its, I believe, fourth week?
Well, I would say that the for people who are paying attention to the trial, it's not going well for Donald Trump. I mean, it just seems to me pretty obvious that, you know, they've laid out, it's the case really isn't all that complicated. I think people sort of overcomplicated it in anticipation of it. But as they're laying it out, it seems to me that it's not going to be difficult for this jury to find him guilty of the crimes that he's been charged with, assuming there isn't a ringer on the jury, you know, somebody who's just a dyed-in-the-wool Trumper and decides to, you know, to hold out and they have to declare a mistrial. But that's for people who are paying attention. And, you know, we've been reading a whole lot of stuff lately. There have been polling and studies and all kinds of things telling us that, you know, the people aren't paying much attention to politics, generally speaking. And to the extent they do, it's a very, very, you know, walled off bubble sort of, you know, kind of media environment where a lot of people who may be Trump fans, they're just not hearing about this. I mean, what they hear is that it's a terribly unfair situation, that he's being persecuted. He's the new Nelson Mandela slash, you know, Gandhi slash Jesus Christ. And he can't possibly be guilty of any of this stuff. And even if he was, she's a horrible person. And, you know, she, whatever. So, well, you know, they're not here. They're just not hearing much. So I don't know, just generally speaking, I honestly don't know how this is affecting people. But one of the things that is seems to be coming through in all the polling is that if he is convicted, that it is going to, that's actually going to make some people kind of stand up and take notice. Now, do I think that the dyed-in-the-wool Trumpers are not, are going to, you know, they're just going to say as a bunch of New Yorkers, you know, Hillary Clinton fans or something. But there is there a group of people, such as maybe the 20% of Republicans who voted for Nikki Haley last night in the deep red state of Indiana?
Yeah.
Among those people, are there some who say that a conviction will definitely change their minds about voting for Trump? Will that hold up? I'm kind of thinking that it might, that there, I mean, I'm just talking of small percentage,
right?
But if those people are paying any attention, and some of them probably are, they're never Trumper types, or, you know, people who, you know, they may not like either one, but whatever, you know, and that there's a conviction, that may be one of those things that actually changes a few minds if they hear about it. And they will. The conviction will definitely penetrate, right?
I saw, I think it was Josh Green of Politico on HBO's Real Time last week saying that he didn't believe that the trial was receiving the coverage that it merits in the mainstream media due to a lot of factors. I know you and I and Keith, et cetera, are following it every day. But he suggests that it's not getting the coverage from the mainstream media, which now, of course, that was before a porn star took the stand to talk about sex with Donald Trump. But is it even possible that it's not getting the coverage in the mainstream media that you and I and Keith might think it certainly deserves, but that you and I and Keith may think it actually is receiving at this point?
Well, it's interesting because I think certainly the cable news networks are covering it. The non-right-wing cable news networks, you know, CNN and MSNBC, they're all over it.
Is
There's
Fox,
no doubt.
Is Fox covering it?
No, Fox is not. I don't consider them mainstream media. I guess they
right.
sort of are, but, you know, they're right-wing media.
Uh-huh.
And they're not covering it, and neither is Newsmax or OAN or anything else.
Really?
However, is it getting coverage? I did see a thing where it said that it was leading the news on the nightly news, which surprisingly to me, turns out that quite a few people still watch those shows.
I guess.
I don't, but, you know, whatever. And the newspapers, you know, I don't know, you know, there's a big discussion to be had about how newspapers are covering this election in general and Donald Trump specifically.
Yeah.
But the, you know, they are covering it, but not with the kind of blazing sort of headlines that you might expect, because I think probably because the tabloid aspect of it kind of makes them feel a little eh. Now, what about local news? Because a lot of people watch local news.
Right.
And, you know, and the morning shows, you know, shows like the Today Show and Good Morning America. A lot of people watch those shows. And I am not actually aware of them covering this with any real, you know, kind of urgency. So if that's where you're getting your news, it may be that you're really not hearing about it.
Keith, let's move on to some of these actual legal details from this week. Trump's lead defense attorney, Todd Blanche, eventually moved for a mistrial based on Daniels' detailed testimony, saying that it was elicited by prosecutors for, quote, pure embarrassment and to, quote, inflame the jury. The motion for mistrial was rejected by Judge Mershon, but why would details about the alleged sexual tryst be even a potential cause for mistrial?
Well, I think that Daniels's testimony was a little bit unexpected. You know, Trump invites her to dinner. And by the way, if Trump invites you to a dinner date, don't expect dinner.
Right.
And then There is no dinner. He meets her in his red satin pajamas.
Yeah.
You know, and lures her into the bedroom with a trick. You know, telling her.
You don't have to repeat this, Keith, or I'm going to move for a mistrial. I already had to put everybody through this.
It is all pretty ick.
It is. It's very ick. But why is that cause for a mistrial? It happened.
Well, because it suddenly looks, and the term I've come up with for this is quasi-non-consensual.
Uh-huh.
And
okay.
I mean, she never said it was non-consensual. Mm-hmm. She's never described it as rape. But I think that a lot of people hearing that narrative that she gave would view it as not fully consensual.
Okay. Either. And if it wasn't, why would that not be something that was admissible in this case?
Well, because evidence of prior wrongs isn't admissible to show consistency of conduct. And the jury's supposed to be determining whether or not Trump committed this business fraud and not whether or not he had a potentially nearly non-consensual, you know, trieste with a adult, you know, adult mm-hmm. movie star.
But it seems to me that's important.
Viewed as the defense is extremely prejudicial and not having on the other side of it. You know, on the other, it's a balancing question of how prejudicial it is to the defendant versus useful or valuable in proving the issue that should be before the jury. And what, you know, the defense is saying is that in terms of that balance, it contributes almost nothing in determining whether or not Trump committed business fraud. But on the other hand, it's extremely prejudicial to, you know, the jury viewing him personally.
Yeah, but it explains why he committed a business fraud, why he falsified checks to cover all of this up. Because if this material came out where, you know, he was, a 60-year-old man at the time, she was 27 years old, as you say, it's a quasi-non-consensual. If that material comes out, that would obviously be very damaging to somebody in the weeks before the 2016 election. I guess I'm confused because I hear people saying, well, you know, it will be prejudicial to the jury. Shouldn't it be prejudicial to the jury? I mean, I'm having trouble wrapping my head around that.
And that's what the prosecution's answer was, is look, this goes to motive. This shows why Trump was so desperate to keep this from getting in front of the American public, you know, shortly before the election. Uh-huh. And that's a good argument, but you know, how, you know, you've already got most of the motive there just by the relationship with the adult film star happening. To go into the details of it that suddenly looks, you know, like maybe it's a little bit non-consensual. Mm-hmm. She's never said that.
Mm-hmm.
Is something that, you know, the defense said, look, the court set up guardrails here. And the prosecution and the witness went outside of them, so we demand a mistrial. And, of course, the judge's answer was, well, doggone it, you were supposed to object then, and you didn't do it.
Mm.
So it sounds to me, Keith, like you're saying that the prosecution was walking a fine line between having to establish that, yes, the sex encounter did actually happen, and here are the details that corroborate and make you give some credibility to Stormy Daniels' testimony, but then also trying not to stray into too much detail in order that might make the jury just hate Donald Trump on a personal level because of this thing that's actually he's not charged with.
That's right. And it's once again, under the rules of evidence, that balancing test on how valuable is that contribution of evidence towards showing that Trump is guilty of the crime charged versus how prejudicial it is to him.
Keith, when the motion for that mistrial was made, it was ultimately rejected. But was the jury there? Is the jury there when a motion for a mistrial is made? No,
the jury was not there. That they did that coming back from lunch. OK, and the jury had not been brought back in yet. Mm-hmm. When Trump's attorney stood up and said, we want a mistrial. Gotcha. So that argument that did occur and that we've heard about played outside of the jury's ears.
But they do hear when the defense team issues an objection, of course, during testimony to, you know, certain questions and so forth. You focused on that in your coverage at Daily Kos a number of times, suggesting that it can be a mistake by the defense to object too much because it sort of signals to the jury what it is that the defense doesn't want them to hear, essentially.
Yeah, that was regarding the testimony the day before by the financial officials from mm-hmm. the Trump organization itself, you know, friends of Trump.
Yeah.
Testifying as to documents. And by the way, I thought that the testimony, you know, on Monday was actually far more important to the case than the dramatic testimony from Stormy Daniels yesterday.
Well, we will yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, when you object to something like that in front of the jury, it signals to the jury, hey, they didn't want us to see this. That must be something, you know, bad.
Right.
Really bad if they didn't want us to see it. And gotcha. Then when the judge overrules the objection and says, well, you know, the message to the jury is that this was something that we definitely should be able to see and the defense didn't want us to see, you just amplify the importance of that negative evidence in their minds.
And I hope to get to some of that other testimony in a bit. But Heather, sticking with Stormy's testimony for the moment, that's going to continue during cross-examination by the defense on Thursday. There may be a redirect by the prosecution thereafter. But for now, with the original direct testimony done and the cross-examination underway, what did you find the most noteworthy and or troubling from her testimony to date as of Tuesday? And I leave it to you if you want to be quite as detailed as Keith obviously wishes to be.
Well, I think we've heard enough
okay.
of what
okay.
specifically happened there.
Uh-huh.
I think we know, and we had heard this before, by the way. I mean, this is a story that she's told, you know, repeatedly over the course of several years now, and she's been pretty consistent. I mean, there have been some minor details that have changed, but for the most part, this has been her story. This idea of it being non-consensual, you know, that had always sort of been there because she had said from the very beginning that when she came out and saw him on the bed, that she kind of rolled her eyes and went, oh boy, here we go. Which for a woman in her position, I think she's never said that she was, that this was non-consensual or that it was even, you know, overtly coerced, but she kind of knew what the story was mm-hmm. and just sort of went along with it. Mm. And to me, that lends her credibility because
yes.
I can see someone in this situation just kind of going, oh, geez, you know, how long can it take, you know? Mm-hmm. And luckily for her, it didn't take very long and she got out. But, you know, I think that's part of what this is about is that, and you saw this with Don Jr. Yesterday, where he was tweeting throughout extortion, extortion. The defense is going to say that this was an extortion plot by Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen. And it may be even be that they're going to say Michael Cohen was extorting Donald Trump. I mean, we don't know that yet, mm-hmm. but let's just say I wouldn't be surprised that he extorted him for that payback, right? That Trump knew nothing about it. And he came and said, hey, you know, boss, if you don't don't pay me, I'm going to go to the press or something. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think that's believable, but I could see them doing it. And certainly they're already saying that Stormy Daniels is an extortionist. And so having her give this detail the way that she did, I think that actually, it, you know, as much as they walked up to the line and maybe crossed it in some ways, I think it was important because if they're going to believe that this wasn't an extortion plot, they've got to believe that she made this up, these details and great, you know, sort of graphic,
right.
vivid kind of color about this encounter. And I think that it. You know, I think it helps to sort of have hear her say that stuff in terms of, you know, assessing her own credibility.
And,
so I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that a lot of these things, the details that she did, you know, offer seem to me to be provable things, that, you know, if you're going to claim that she's lying, I mean, Keith Barber, didn't Trump bring a whole lot of this on himself by denying that the affair even happened, that he he never even knew this woman. Maybe he met her once. Doesn't that require that she thoroughly prove her story with specific details and, you know, corroboration that others heard him on the speakerphone when he would call her once a week or so? Isn't that detail necessary for exactly that? And didn't he bring this on himself by, instead of saying, well, yes, it happened, but no, there was no hush money payment to shut her up or whatever? He denied everything, even meeting her. So it seems like he's got his own self to blame for a lot of this, no?
Yeah, and you notice that on cross-examination, the defense did not try to argue those points about all those contacts that Trump had with her after this incident.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he went to Trump Tower, that he was, you know, calling her and holding out the bait, if you will, of a potential appearance on The Apprentice in order to, you know, hook up with her again. And you know, and she testified that every time he called her, she put him on speakerphone, and that dozens and dozens of people, you know, yeah, heard him calling her Honey Bunch and things like that. And the defense didn't contest that at all. That's not going to be lost to the jury. Well, instead, what did, you know, he do? You know, his defense counsel is supposed to be this really good team of people. Actually, in many ways, you know, got too ham-fisted and were outsmarted by the adult industry star.
I know that the defense attorney, Susan Nicholas, tried to poke holes in Daniel's story late on Tuesday, particularly about her story about being approached by someone in a parking lot in Las Vegas, I think, and threatening her if she ever told her story. Nicholas at one point said, "You hate President Trump?" And Stormy responded, "Yes." Now, to me, that actually makes her seem more human and that she was telling the truth on the stand. No? Did the defense have any success in poking holes in her story
so
far?
No, they did it horribly. You don't do it the way the defense counsel tried to do it. You know, at one point, in discussing that incident, the defense counsel said, "This man never existed, did he?" And Daniel said, "He absolutely existed." And the defense counsel said, "Isn't this story made up?" And Daniel says, "None of it's made up." Well, you don't do it that way. You don't ask the witness, "Aren't you a liar?" Which is, you know, you don't do that. But consider this question instead. Well, you didn't report it to the police, did you? No. Well, if you had reported it to the police, wouldn't there have been the possibility that security footage would have been able to have shown this happening?
Mm, right.
And of course, Daniels probably says, "Well, I don't know." But the jury sits there and hears that and goes, "Uh-huh."
But that was not what she asked. That was not
what
the defense attorney did.
That is not what she asked. And that's what, that's the difference between, you know, good attorneys and bad attorneys in this thing. And that question would have been more helpful, a lot more helpful to Trump than just trying to scream to the jury that Daniels is a liar. And of course, there's a reason that happened, is that that's what Trump wanted them to do.
Yeah.
And so they were doing what their client wanted rather than sound trial practice.
Gotcha. Because Susan Nicholas is supposed to be a very experienced defense attorney. I guess she's represented a lot of mobsters, apparently, as I understand it. And so, yeah, it was kind of unusual for her to, you know, I mean, it seemed like it was right out of a very bad movie or TV show, that particular exchange. Didn't you do this? False. You did do this, didn't you? False. I mean, it was crazy.
It was, you know, a few good men. Did you order that Coke Rack?
Exactly. I mean, yes. Heather.
Just nuts.
Heather, late last week, longtime Trump aide Hope Hicks took the stand and testified to Trump telling her in 2018, when the Stormy hush money stuff came to light, that Trump had told her Michael Cohen paid off Stormy Daniels. He didn't tell anybody. He did so out of the kindness of his heart, which Hope Hicks testified did not sound like the Michael Cohen that she knew. And, you know, that Trump expressed to her that, oh, boy, wasn't it a good thing that the story came out in 2018 rather than before the 2016 election? And then when cross-examination by the defense began shortly thereafter, Hope Hicks broke down and cried. So, two-part question. Why did she cry? And what do you make of Hope Hicks's testimony? And is that effective in this particular case?
Well, I think it was very effective. And I think the reason is that she was crying because she knew that she had just given some devastating detail to her former boss, who apparently, for reasons I will never understand, she has a tremendous amount of fondness for. She said, in her saying that he told her that in 2018, what he said was, essentially admitted, was that he knew that this was reimbursement for that hush money.
Mm-hmm.
And in knowing that it was reimbursement for that hush money, that means that when he was signing those checks for, quote, legal expenses, that he knew that it was actual reimbursement. Now, they're going to claim, and he's been coming out there every day ever since then saying, well, yeah, I said it was legal expenses. I mean, he's a lawyer, right? So it was a legal expense, blah,
right.
blah, blah. That's not going to cut it, because what he was saying there, they weren't legal expenses. They were reimbursements. And there was other testimony this week, which had, you know, they showed that it was written on the actual bank statement of Michael Cohen, mm-hmm. was the deal to pay him back in Alan Weisselberg's handwriting, mm-hmm. and in what's his name, McConney, the controller's
Jeffrey
handwriting. Jeffrey McConney, that it's written there on the actual bank statement of how they're going to pay Michael Cohen back. That is no one's definition of a legal expense. That's not a legal expense. That's a reimbursement. And it's not only a reimbursement. It was, they actually doubled it in order to cover his taxes. That is not considered a legal expense either. Now, I don't know, you know, they're probably going to have to call some people in to sort of say, you know, what's a legal expense? How's that defined in New York code, or
right.
if there's some way to do that. But the fact that he knew, that Hope Hicks said that he knew that it was reimbursement, and said that it was about the election. Boy, it sure is good that it came out before the election, after the election, right? That was a devastating blow to his defense, because that's somebody who he trusted. She had total credibility as being a Trumper. In fact, mm-hmm. her crying actually helped the prosecution, I think, because it showed that this was really hard for her to say this, and that she didn't want to say it, but she had to because she was under oath.
Gotcha.
So I think it was a very important testimony. And I think, you know, Trump, you know, that's Hopi. That's his girl. And she came out and basically said that he knew. And that was a pretty big deal.
Over the on the matter of legal expenses, which you pay to your lawyer, and that is income to that lawyer, versus reimbursement, where you're just paying them back, so there's no actual tax event because it's not income. It seems there's a very clear difference in what those two things are. Keith, you mentioned it at the top of this segment, and you wrote about it over at Daily Kos, about the testimony from Jeffrey McConney, the Trump Organization controller, and Deborah Tarasoff, the still-serving supervisor of accounts payable at the Trump Organization, that you thought, even though it was kind of dry and boring, that was a big deal, the testimony from those two.
Yeah, that's, I think, the most key testimony so far in this case. It may be the most important testimony by the time it's done. This is a documents case, right? This isn't really a witness case. This is a documents case. This is documents fraud, and the documents themselves, to a large degree, mostly prove the fraud. And it was, they used these two witnesses to present the documents and explain to the jury how that money was recorded on the company's books as, you know, business expense / legal services expense. And everybody knows that's not true. I don't know that we have to have a precise definition of legal expenses to know that hush money to a porn star isn't it.
Well, but there's another problem, really, because the heart of this case is obviously that Trump directed this hush money to the porn star, that he directed this operation. But so far, anyway, there has been no actual testimony to my knowledge that places Trump himself as personally directing the scheme. Yes, you've got the, you know, on the statement, you've got Weisselberg's handwriting, you know, breaking down what all of this money is for. He could have been doing that on his own. It's feasible that Michael Cohen could have paid this money to Stormy Daniels on his own because he's such a devotee of Donald Trump. So far, there doesn't seem to be any evidence of Trump himself personally directing this scheme, you know, telling his bookkeepers to hide the payments as a legal expense and so forth. Presumably, Michael Cohen will speak to that during his upcoming testimony, but the defense can obviously have a field day with Michael Cohen for his past, for lying in the past and so forth. Is that lack of testimony about Trump personally directing this scheme, is that going to be a problem for the prosecution?
Trump's signature is on the checks.
Yeah, but he didn't. But did he know that it was a check for an unlawful purpose? You know, if he thought it was a legal expense, he thought it was a legal expense. Oh, I got to pay my lawyers.
He knows that it's a check going to Michael Cohen, and that Michael Cohen hasn't provided any actual legal services to get it. I mean, that's what the testimony is going to be. The testimony, you know, who was it from McConaughey, I think, that basically said that the invoices that Cohen sent in were just ridiculous. You know, they were silly. They made some vague references to a retainer agreement that, to the best of you know, anyone's knowledge, nobody had ever seen, and it's still never been produced.
He's the president at this time. He's got to sign thousands of things. He's very, very busy. They send him some stuff that he needs to sign from the Trump organization. Okay, let me sign this. Let me sign that.
He wasn't supposed to be doing that, by the way, president, you know, any Trump organization business was supposed to be handled by others. And the fact that he was handling it personally kind of indicates that it was something that, you know, he specifically needed to do, right?
This whole scheme was set up with in advance, and that was a whole, you know, a lot of the purpose of having David Pecker's testimony was showing, look, we're going to be doing this, we're going to be paying hush money. They even anticipated that it might involve more than one woman could be involved, and that Pecker would refer them to Trump, and they would find a way to kill the story. And so all of this was part, you know, and then there's also the recording, by the way,
right,
that Cohen made associated with McDougal, where they talk about setting up a shell company for her payment. Now that wasn't eventually done, but it shows that, you know, Trump is, you know, hip deep in this whole thing right from the beginning.
Well, fair enough. But I think that the defense is going to make the case that they don't put Donald Trump anywhere. You know, the McDougal case, that's a separate deal. That was not this deal. That is not what these 34 falsified business documents are actually about. Seems to me the prosecution is going to have to speak to that, because I think the defense is going to, if they don't. Though that is what we will get from Michael Cohen, and we'll see how that
goes. That's what it's going to be. Yeah. Michael Cohen is going to be the person who puts Trump in it. And yes, they're going to try and destroy Michael Cohen, but they've set up all this stuff ahead of time that had to do. I mean, what else was Michael Cohen doing for Donald Trump during this period except doing these catch and kill things? That was his job. That's what he did. And they've already set up, and they have it on tape, and they have David Pecker saying it. He was talking to Michael Cohen every other day. All the lawyers that were working for McDougal and Stormy Daniels were talking to Michael Cohen every day. Not as if Michael Cohen is just saying, you know, out of the blue that he was dealing with this stuff. I mean, this was something that was going on, and Pecker knew that testified that Trump was personally involved and asked him, you know, called him into his office and said, hey, what can you do to help me out? You know, dude, you know, what are you? And Pecker said, we'll do catch and kill. How about that? And so they know that he was on there. So Michael Cohen will say, you know, yes, you know, I'm a complete jackass and I'm a liar and blah, blah, blah. But everybody knows that I was deeply involved in this particular scheme that I was doing on behalf of Donald Trump, and this Stormy Daniels payoff was part of it. And so what the jury will have to do then is completely, you know, say, okay, this is a one-off, that Michael Cohen is the only one he did all by himself. Without Trump involved, he just did it. And that's probably what they're going to try and say. The defense will say,
but
yeah,
it's so implausible.
Like you said, that goes beyond, you know, I mean, that's not a rational sort of assumption. So I think it's the best they can do, because they don't have him on tape, but yeah, you know, they do have a witness.
I have a feeling we may be picking up this story probably right there around this same time next week. We will see. I've got just a minute I have to get out, guys. So a quick answer here from both of you on this. Over the past week, Judge Mershon found Trump guilty of criminal contempt for violating his gag order in the New York trial for the 10th time, threatening really truly this time jail. For another violation, is Trump capable of keeping himself out of jail on contempt charges? And is Judge Mershon capable of actually pulling that trigger? Heather first, Keith second.
Okay, I think Mershon may have to if Trump keeps doing it. But it's interesting that he does seem to have backed off quite a bit. Trump does not want to go to jail. They don't have hair and makeup people in there, so it's a real problem.
Right. That's right. Keith?
Yes, and Trump has already indicated, you know, that he's kind of gotten the message. He was able to get the message in the civil court case as well. He shut up there. He posted recently, you know, on Truth Social a message that kind of danced close to the line talking about the jury, and then he quickly deleted it. He's heard it, and he doesn't want to go to jail, no matter how much he'll tell his stupid MAGA followers that he does.
Keith Barber, who lives among stupid MAGA followers down in Florida, is the former attorney, former Republican, now blogging at Daily Kos. You can find him over there at the username KeithDB and on Twitter at KeithDB80. And, of course, Heather Digby Parton can be found regularly at Salon.com and her own blog, digbysblog.net, and on the Twitters at Digby56. Thank you guys for everything. Greatly appreciate the quick catch up with a K. Hope to look forward to doing it again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brad.
All right. We have got to get out. Thanks also to our producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. No paywall there, thanks to those of you who go to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, a site still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.